Side 4. The Shining. The water ran ceaselessly in the basin, and Wendy felt that she had suddenly stepped into some grinding nightmare where time ran backward to the time when her drunken husband had broken her son's arm and had then mewled over him in almost exactly the same words. "Oh, honey, I'm sorry, Dot, please, so sorry." She ran to them both, pried Danny out of Jack's arms somehow. She saw the look of angry reproach on his face, but filed it away for later consideration, and lifted him up. She walked him back into the small bedroom, Danny's arms clasped around her neck, Jack trailing them. She sat down on Danny's bed and rocked him back and forth, soothing him with nonsensical words repeated over and over. She looked up at Jack, and there was only worry in his eyes now. He raised questioning eyebrows at her. She shook her head faintly. "Danny," she said. "Danny, Danny, Danny, it's okay, Doc, it's fine." At last Danny was quiet, only faintly trembling in her arms. Yet it was Jack he spoke to first, Jack who was now sitting beside them on the bed, and she felt the old faint pang. It's him first, and it's always been him first, of jealousy. Jack had shouted at him, she had comforted him, yet it was to his father that Danny said, "I'm sorry if I was bad." "Nothing to be sorry for, Doc." Jack ruffled his hair. "What the hell happened in there?" Danny shook his head slowly, dazedly.
I don't know. "Why did you tell me to stop stuttering, Daddy? I don't stutter."
"Of course not," Jack said heartily, but Wendy felt a cold finger touch her heart. Jack suddenly looked scared, as if he'd seen something that might just have been a ghost.
"Something about the timer," Danny muttered.
"What?" Jack was leaning forward, and Danny flinched in her arms.
"Jack, you're scaring him," she said,
and her voice was high, accusatory. It suddenly came to her that they were all scared. But of what?
"I don't know, I don't know," Danny was saying to his father. What did I say, Daddy?"
"Nothing," Jack muttered. He took his handkerchief from his back pocket and wiped his mouth with it. Wendy had a moment of that sickening time is running backward feeling again. It was a gesture she remembered well from his drinking days.
"Why did you lock the door, Danny?" she asked gently. "Why did you do that?" "Tony," he said. "Tony told me to."
They exchanged a glance over the top of his head.
"Did Tony say why, son?" Jack asked quietly.
"I was brushing my teeth, and I was thinking about my reading," Danny said. "Thinking real hard, and I saw Tony way down in the mirror. He said he had to show me again."
"You mean he was behind you?" Wendy asked.
"No, he was in the mirror."
Danny was very emphatic on this point.
"Way down deep. And then I went through the mirror. Well, the next thing I remembered, Daddy was shaking me, and I thought I was being bad again."
Jack winced as if struck.
"No, Doc," he said quietly.
"Tony told you to lock the door?" Wendy asked, brushing his hair. "Yes."
"And what did he want to show you?" Danny tensed in her arms. It was as if the muscles in his body had turned into something like piano wire.
"I don't remember," he said, distraught. "I don't remember. Don't ask me. I don't remember nothing."
"Shh," Wendy said, alarmed. She began to rock him again.
"It's all right if you don't remember, hun. Sure it is."
At last, Danny began to relax again.
"Do you want me to stay a little while? Read you a story?"
"No, just the nightlight."
He looked shyly at his father.
"Would you stay, Daddy, for a minute?"
"Sure, Doc."
Wendy sighed.
"I'll be in the living room, Jack."
"Okay." She got up and watched as Danny slid under the covers. He seemed very small.
"Are you sure you're okay, Danny?"
"I'm okay. Just plug in Snoopy, Mom."
"Sure."
She plugged in the nightlight, which showed Snoopy lying fast asleep on top of his doghouse. He had never wanted a nightlight until they moved into the Overlook, and then he had specifically requested one.
She turned off the lamp and the overhead and looked back at them, the small white circle of Danny's face and Jack's above it. She hesitated a moment.
"And then I went through the mirror."
And then left them quietly. "You sleepy?" Jack asked, brushing Danny's hair off his forehead.
"Yeah."
"Want a drink of water?"
"No."
There was silence for 5 minutes. Danny was still beneath his hand. Thinking the boy had dropped off, he was about to get up and leave quietly when Danny said from the brink of sleep,
"Roke."
Jack turned back, all zero at the bone. "Danny?"
"You'd never hurt Mommy, would you, Daddy?"
"No."
"Or me?"
"No." Silence again, spinning out.
"Daddy."
"What?"
"Tony came and told me about Roke."
"Did he, Doc? What did he say?"
"I don't remember much, except he said it was in innings, like baseball. Isn't that funny?"
"Yes." Jack's heart was thudding dully in his chest. How could the boy possibly know a thing like that? Roke was played by innings. Not like baseball, but like cricket.
"Daddy?"
He was almost asleep now.
"What?" "What's Red Drum?"
"Red Drum? Sounds like something an Indian might take on the warpath." Silence. "Hey, Doc?" But Danny was asleep, breathing in long, slow strokes. Jack sat looking down at him for a moment, and a rush of love pushed through him like tidal water. Why had he yelled at the boy like that? It was perfectly normal for him to stutter a little. He had been coming out of a daze or some weird kind of trance, and stuttering was perfectly normal under those circumstances. Perfectly. And he hadn't said timer at all. It had been something else. Nonsense. Gibberish. How had he known Roke was played in innings, had someone told him? Ullman? Halloran? He looked down at his hands. They were made into tight, clenched fists of tension. God, how I need a drink. And the nails were digging into his palms like tiny brands. Slowly, he forced them to open. "I love you, Danny," he whispered. "God knows I do." He left the room. He had lost his temper again. Only a little, but enough to make him feel sick and afraid. A drink would blunt that feeling. Oh, yes, it would blunt that. Something about the timer. And everything else. There was no mistake about those words at all. None. Each had come out clear as a bell. He paused in the hallway, looking back, and automatically wiped his lips with his handkerchief. Their shapes were only dark silhouettes in the glow of the nightlight. Wendy, wearing only panties, went to his bed and tucked him in again. He had kicked the covers back. Jack stood in the doorway, watching as she put her inner wrist against his forehead. "Is he feverish?"
"No."
She kissed his cheek. "Thank God you made that appointment," he said as she came back to the doorway. "You think that guy knows his stuff?" "The checker said he was very good, that's all I know." "If there's something wrong, I'm going to send you and him to your mother's, Wendy."
"No."
"I know," he said, putting an arm around her, "how you feel."
"You don't know how I feel at all about her."
"Wendy, there's no place else I can send you. You know that."
"If you came..."
"Without this job, we're done," he said simply. "You know that." Her silhouette nodded slowly. She knew it. "When I had that interview with Ullman, I thought he was just blowing off his bazoo. Now I'm not so sure. Maybe I really shouldn't have tried this with you two along. 40 miles from nowhere."
"I love you," she said. "And Danny loves you even more, if that's possible."
"He would have been heartbroken, Jack. He will be if you send us away." "Don't make it sound that way."
"If the doctor says there's something wrong, I'll look for a job in Sidewinder," she said. "If I can't get one in Sidewinder, Danny and I will go back to Boulder. I can't go to my mother, Jack. Not on those terms. Don't ask me. I just can't."
"I guess I know that."
"Cheer up. Maybe it's nothing."
"Maybe." "The appointment's at 2?
"Yes."
"Let's leave the bedroom door open, Wendy."
"I want to, but I think he'll sleep through now."
But he didn't. Boom. Boom. Boom, 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 boom!
He fled the heavy, crashing, echoing sounds through twisting, maze-like corridors, his bare feet whispering over a deep-piled jungle of blue and black. Each time he heard the rope mallet smash into the wall somewhere behind him, he wanted to scream aloud, but he mustn't. He mustn't. The scream would give him away, and then, Redrum.
Come out here and take your medicine, you fucking crybaby.
Oh, and he could hear the owner of that voice coming for him, charging up the hall like a tiger in an alien blue-black jungle, a man-eater.
Come out here, you little son of a bitch.
If he could get to the stairs going down, if he could get off this third floor, he might be all right, even the elevator. If he could remember what had been forgotten. But it was dark, and in his terror he had lost his orientation. He had turned down one corridor and then another, his heart leaping into his mouth like a hot lump of ice, fearing that each turn would bring him face to face with the human tiger in these halls. The booming was right behind him now, the awful hoarse shouting. The whistle the head of the mallet made cutting through the air, roke, stroke, roke, stroke, Redrum, before it crashed into the wall. The soft whisper of feet on the jungle carpet, panic squirting in his mouth like bitter juice.
You will remember what was forgotten, but would he?
What was it? He fled around another corner and saw with creeping, utter horror that he was in a cul-de-sac. Locked doors frowned down at him from three sides. The West Wing. He was in the West Wing, and outside he could hear the storm whooping and screaming, seeming to choke on its own dark throat filled with snow. He backed up against the wall, weeping with terror now, his heart racing like the heart of a rabbit caught in a snare. When his back was against the light blue silk wallpaper with the embossed pattern of wavy lines, his legs gave way, and he collapsed to the carpet, hands splayed on the jungle of woven vines and creepers, the breath whistling in and out of his throat. Louder, louder. There was a tiger in the hall, and now the tiger was just around the corner, still crying out in that shrill and petulant and lunatic rage, the rope mallet slamming, because this tiger walked on two legs, and it was... He woke with a sudden indrawn gasp, sitting bolt upright in bed, his eyes wide and staring into the darkness, hands crossed in front of his face. Something on one hand, crawling. Wasps! Three of them! They stung him then, seeming to needle all at once. And that was when all the images broke apart and fell on him in a dark flood, and he began to shriek into the dark, the wasps clinging to his left hand, stinging again and again. The lights went on, and Daddy was standing there in his shorts, his eyes glaring, Mommy behind him, sleepy and scared.
Get them off me!
Danny screamed.
Oh, my God, Jack said.
He saw.
Jack, what's wrong with him? What's wrong?
He didn't answer her. He ran to the bed, scooped up Danny's pillow, and slapped Danny's thrashing left hand with it. Again, again, Wendy saw lumbering, insectile forms rise into the air, droning.
Get a magazine, he yelled over his shoulder. Kill them!
Wasps,
she said, and for a moment she was inside herself, almost detached in her realization that her mind was cross-patched and knowledge was connected to emotion.
Wasps! Oh, Jesus, Jack, you said...
Shut the fuck up and kill them, he roared. Will you do what I say?
One of them had landed on Danny's reading desk. She took a coloring book off his work table and slammed it down on the wasp. It left a viscous brown smear. There's another one on the curtain, he said, and ran out past her with Danny in his arms. He took the boy into their bedroom and put him on Wendy's side of the makeshift double. Lie right there, Danny. Don't come back until I tell you. Understand? His face puffed and streaked with tears. Danny nodded.
That's my brave boy.
Jack ran back down the hall to the stairs. Behind him he heard the coloring book slap twice, and then his wife screamed in pain. He didn't slow, but went down the stairs two by two into the darkened lobby. He went through Ullman's office into the kitchen, slamming the heavy part of his thigh into the corner of Ullman's oak desk, barely feeling it. He slapped on the kitchen overheads and crossed to the sink. The washed dishes from supper were still heaped up in the drainer where Wendy had left them to drip dry. He snatched the big Pyrex bowl off the top. A dish fell to the floor and exploded. Ignoring it, he turned and ran back through the office and up the stairs. Wendy was standing outside Danny's door, breathing hard. Her face was the color of table linen. Her eyes were shiny and flat. Her hair hung damply against her neck.
I got them all, she said dully. But one stung me. Jack, you said they were all dead.
She began to cry.
He slipped past her without answering and carried the Pyrex bowl over to the nest by Danny's bed. It was still, nothing there, on the outside anyway. He slammed the bowl down over the nest. "There," he said. "Come on." They went back into their bedroom. "Where did it get you?" he asked her.
On my wrist."
"Let's see." She showed it to him. Just above the bracelet of lines between wrist and palm, there was a small circular hole. The flesh around it was puffing up. "Are you allergic to stings?" he asked. "Well, think hard. If you are, Danny might be. The fucking little bastard's got him 5 or 6 times." "No," she said more calmly. I just hate them, that's all.
Hate them."
Danny was sitting on the foot of the bed, holding his left hand and looking at them. His eyes, circled with the white of shock, looked at Jack reproachfully.
"Daddy, you said you killed them all. My hand, it really hurts."
"Let's see it, Doc." "No, I'm not going to touch it. That would make it hurt even more. Just hold it out." He did, and Wendy moaned.
"Oh, Danny, oh, your poor hand."
Later, the doctor would count 11 separate stings. Now all they saw was a dotting of small holes, as if his palm and fingers had been sprinkled with grains of red pepper. The swelling was bad. His hand had begun to look like one of those cartoon images where Bugs Bunny or Daffy Duck has just slammed himself with a hammer. "Wendy, go get that spray stuff in the bathroom," he said. She went after it, and he sat down next to Danny and slipped an arm around his shoulders. "After we spray your hand, I want to take some Polaroids of it, Doc. Then you sleep the rest of the night with us, okay?"
"Sure," Danny said. "But why are you going to take pictures?"
"So maybe we can sue the ass out of some people."
Wendy came back with a spray tube in the shape of a chemical fire extinguisher. "This won't hurt, honey," she said, taking off the cap. Danny held out his hand, and she sprayed both sides until it gleamed. He let out a long, shuddery sigh.
"Does it smart?" she asked. "No. Feels better."
"Now these. Crunch them up."
She held out 5 orange-flavored baby aspirin. Danny took them and popped them into his mouth one by one.
"Isn't that a lot of aspirin?" Jack asked.
"It's a lot of stings," she snapped at him angrily. "You go and get rid of that nest, John Torrance, right now."
"Just a minute." He went to the dresser and took his Polaroid square shooter out of the top drawer. He rummaged deeper and found some flash cubes.
"Jack, what are you doing?" she asked, a little hysterically.
"He's gonna take some pictures of my hand," Danny said gravely, "and then we're gonna sue the ass out of some people. Like that?"
"Right," Jack said grimly.
He had found the flash attachment, and he jabbed it onto the camera.
"Hold it out, son. I figure about $5,000 a sting."
"What are you talking about?"
Wendy nearly screamed.
"I'll tell you what," he said. "I followed the directions on that fucking bug bomb. We're going to sue them. The damn thing was defective. Had to have been. How else can you explain this?"
"Oh," she said in a small voice. He took 4 pictures, pulling out each covered print for Wendy to time on the small locket watch she wore around her neck. Danny, fascinated with the idea that his stung hand might be worth thousands and thousands of dollars, began to lose some of his fright and take an active interest. The hand throbbed dully, and he had a small headache. When Jack had put the camera away and spread the prints out on top of the dresser to dry, Wendy said, "Should we take him to the doctor tonight?"
"Not unless he's really in pain," Jack said. "If a person has a strong allergy to wasp venom, it hits within 30 seconds.
"Hits? What are you..."
"A coma. Or convulsions."
Oh, my Jesus."
She cupped her hands over her elbows and hugged herself, looking pale and wan.
"Now, how do you feel, son? Do you think you could sleep?"
Danny blinked at them. The nightmare had faded to a dull, featureless background in his mind, but he was still frightened.
"If I can sleep with you..."
"Of course," Wendy said. "Oh, honey, I'm so sorry."
"It's okay, Mommy."
She began to cry again, and Jack put his hands on her shoulders.
"Wendy, I swear to you that I followed the directions. Will you get rid of it in the morning, please?"
"Of course I will."
The 3 of them got in bed together and Jack was about to snap off the light over the bed when he paused and pushed the covers back instead. I want a picture of the nest, too. Come right back.
I will.
He went to the dresser, got the camera and the last flash cube, and gave Danny a closed thumb and forefinger circle. Danny smiled and gave it back with his good hand. Quite a kid, he thought, as he walked out of Danny's room. All of that, and then some. The overhead was still on. Jack crossed to the bunk setup, and as he glanced at the table beside it, his skin crawled into goose flesh. The short hairs on his neck prickled and tried to stand erect. He could hardly see the nest through the clear Pyrex bowl. The inside of the glass was crawling with wasps. It was hard to tell how many, 50 at least, maybe 100. His heart thudding slowly in his chest, he took his pictures and then set the camera down to wait for them to develop. He wiped his lips with the palm of his hand. One thought played over and over in his mind, echoing with, "You lost your temper, you lost your temper, you lost your temper," an almost superstitious dread. They had come back. He had killed the wasps, but they had come back. In his mind, he heard himself screaming into his frightened, crying son's face, "Don't stutter!" He wiped his lips again. He went to Danny's work table, rummaged in its drawers, and came up with a big jigsaw puzzle with a fiberboard backing. He took it over to the bed table and carefully slid the bowl and the nest onto it. The wasps buzzed angrily inside their prison. Then, putting his hand firmly on top of the bowl so it wouldn't slip, he went out to the hall. "Coming to bed, Jack?" Wendy asked.
"Coming to bed, Daddy?"
"I have to go downstairs for a minute," he said, making his voice light. How had it happened? How in God's name? The bomb sure hadn't been a dud. He had seen the thick white smoke start to puff out of it when he had pulled the ring. And when he had gone up 2 hours later, he had shaken a drift of small dead bodies out of the hole in the top. Then how? Spontaneous regeneration? Now that was crazy. 17th century bullshit. Insects didn't regenerate. And even if wasp eggs could mature full-grown insects in 12 hours, this wasn't the season in which the queen laid. That happened in April or May. Fall was their dying time. A living contradiction, the wasps buzzed furiously under the bowl. He took them downstairs and through the kitchen. In back, there was a door which gave on the outside. A cold night wind blew against his nearly naked body, and his feet went numb almost instantly against the cold concrete of the platform he was standing on. The platform where milk deliveries were made during the hotel's operating season. He put the puzzle and the bowl down carefully, and when he stood up, he looked at the thermometer nailed outside the door. Fresh up with 7-Up, the thermometer said, and the mercury stood at an even 25 degrees. The cold would kill them by morning. He went in and shut the door firmly. After a moment's thought, he locked it too. He crossed the kitchen again and shut off the lights. He stood in the darkness for a moment, thinking, wanting a drink. Suddenly the hotel seemed full of 1,000 stealthy sounds, creakings and groans, and the sly sniff of the wind under the eaves where more wasps' nests might be hanging like deadly fruit. They had come back. And suddenly he found that he didn't like the overlook so well anymore, as if it wasn't wasps that had stung his son, wasps that had miraculously lived through the bug bomb assault, but the hotel itself. His last thought before going upstairs to his wife and son, "From now on you will hold your temper no matter what," was firm and hard and sure. As he went down the hall to them, he wiped his lips with the back of his hand. Chapter 17. The Doctor's Office. Stripped to his underpants, lying on the examination table, Danny Torrance looked very small. He was looking up at Dr. Just Call Me Bill Edmonds, who was wheeling a large black machine up beside him. Danny rolled his eyes to get a better look at it.
"Don't let it scare you, guy," Bill Edmonds said. "It's an electroencephalograph, and it doesn't hurt."
"Electro..."
"We call it EEG for short. I'm going to hook a bunch of wires to your head. No, not stick them in, only tape them. And the pins in this part of the gadget will record your brain waves."
"Like on the $6 Million Man?"
"About the same. Would you like to be Steve Austin when you grow up?"
"No way,"
Danny said, as the nurse began to tape the wires to a number of tiny shaved spots on his scalp. My daddy says that someday he'll get a short circuit, and then he'll be up he'll be up the creek. I know that creek well, Dr. Edmund said amiably. I've been up it a few times myself, sans paddle. An EEG can tell us a lot of things, Danny.
Like what?
Oh, like, for instance, if you have epilepsy. That's a little problem where...
Yeah, I know what epilepsy is.
Really?
Sure. There was a kid in my nursery school back in Vermont. I went to nursery school when I was a little kid, and he had it. He wasn't supposed to use the flashboard.
What was that, Dan? He had turned on the machine. Thin lines began to trace their way across graph paper.
It had all these lights, all different colors. And when you turned it on, some colors would flash, but not all. And you had to count the colors, and if you pushed the right button, you could turn it off. Brent couldn't use that.
And that's because bright flashing lights sometimes cause an epileptic seizure.
You mean using the flashboard might have made Brent pitch a fit?
Edmonds and the nurse exchanged a brief, amused glance.
Inelegantly but accurately put, Danny.
What?
I said you're right, except you should say seizure instead of pitch a fit. That's not nice. Okay, lie just as still as a mouse now.
Okay.
Danny, when you have these, well, whatever they are, do you ever recall seeing bright flashing lights before?
No.
Funny noises? Ringing or chimes like a doorbell?
Uh-uh.
Now how about a funny smell? Maybe like oranges or sawdust, or a smell like something rotten?
No, sir.
Sometimes do you feel like crying before you pass out, even though you don't feel sad?
No way.
Well, that's fine, then.
Have I got epilepsy, Dr. Bill?
I don't think so, Danny. Just lie still. Almost done.
The machine hummed and scratched for another 5 minutes, and then Dr. Edmund shut it off.
All done, Guy, Edmund said briskly. Let Sally get these electrodes off you and then come into the next room. I want to have a little talk with you, okay?
Sure.
Sally, you go ahead and give him a time test before he comes in.
All right.
Edmunds ripped off the long curl of paper the machine had extruded and went into the next room looking at it.
I'm going to prick your arm just a little, the nurse said after Danny had pulled up his pants. It's to make sure you don't have TB.
They gave me that at my school just last year, Danny said, without much hope.
Oh, but that was a long time ago, and you're a big boy now, right?
I guess so, Danny sighed, and offered his arm up for sacrifice.
When he had his shirt and shoes on, he went through the sliding door and into Dr. Edmund's office. Edmunds was sitting on the edge of his desk, swinging his legs thoughtfully.
Hi, Danny.
Hi.
How's that hand now?
He pointed at Danny's left hand, which was lightly bandaged.
Pretty good.
Good. I looked at your EEG and it seems fine, but I'm going to send it to a friend of mine in Denver who makes his living reading those things. I just want to make sure.
Yes, sir.
Tell me about Tony, Dan.
Danny shuffled his feet.
He's just an invisible friend, he said. I made him up to keep me company.
Edmunds laughed and put his hands on Danny's shoulders.
Now, that's what your mom and dad say. But this is just between us, Guy. I'm your doctor. Now tell me the truth, and I'll promise not to tell them unless you say I can.
Danny thought about it. He looked at Edmunds, and then, with a small effort of concentration, he tried to catch Edmunds' thoughts, or at least the color of his mood. And suddenly, he got an oddly comforting image in his head. File cabinets, their doors sliding shut one after another, locking with a click. Written on the small tabs in the center of each door was A.C. Secret, D.G. Secret, and so on. This made Danny feel a little easier. Cautiously, he said,
I don't know who Tony is.
Is he your age?
No. He's at least 11. I think he might even be older. I've never seen him right up close. He might be old enough to drive a car.
You just see him at a distance, huh?
Yes, sir.
And he always comes just before you pass out?
Well, I don't pass out. It's like I go with him, and he shows me things.
Oh, what kind of things?
Well...
Danny debated for a moment, and then told Edmonds about Daddy's trunk with all of his writing in it, and about how the movers hadn't lost it between Vermont and Colorado after all. It had been right under the stairs all along.
And your daddy found it where Tony said he would?
Oh, yes, sir. Only Tony didn't tell me. He showed me.
I understand, Danny. What did Tony show you last night, when you locked yourself in the bathroom?
I don't remember, Danny said quickly.
Are you sure?
Yes, sir.
A moment ago, I said you locked the bathroom door. But that wasn't right, was it? Tony locked the door.
No, sir. Tony couldn't lock the door because he isn't real. He wanted me to do it, so I did. I locked it.
Does Tony always show you where lost things are?
No, sir. Sometimes he shows me things that are going to happen.
Really?
Sure. Like one time, Tony showed me the amusements and wild animal park in Great Barrington. Tony said Daddy was going to take me there for my birthday. He did, too.
Well, what else does he show you?
Danny frowned. Signs. He's always showing me stupid old signs, and I can't read them hardly ever.
Why do you suppose Tony would do that, Danny?
I don't know. Danny brightened. But my daddy and mommy are teaching me to read, and I'm trying real hard.
So you can read Tony's signs?
Well, I really want to learn, but that too, yeah.
Do you like Tony, Danny?
Danny looked at the tile floor and said nothing.
Danny?
It's hard to tell, Danny said. I used to. I used to hope he'd come every day, because he always showed me good things, especially since Mommy and Daddy don't think about divorce anymore.
Dr. Redmond's gaze sharpened, but Danny didn't notice. He was looking hard at the floor, concentrating on expressing himself.
But now, whenever he comes, he shows me bad things, awful things, like in the bathroom last night. The things he shows me, they sting me like those wasps stung me. Only Tony's things sting me up here.
He cocked a finger gravely at his temple, a small boy unconsciously burlesquing suicide.
What things, Danny?
I can't remember, Danny cried out, agonized. I'd tell you if I could. It's like I can't remember because it's so bad I don't want to remember. All I can remember when I wake up is Red Drum.
Red Drum or Red Rum?
Rum.
What's that, Danny?
I don't know.
Danny?
Yes, sir?
Can you make Tony come now?
I don't know. He doesn't always come. I don't even know if I want him to come anymore.
I'll try, Danny. I'll be right here.
Danny looked at Edmonds doubtfully. Edmonds nodded encouragement. Danny let out a long, sighing breath and nodded.
But I don't know if it'll work. I never did it with anyone looking at me before, and Tony doesn't always come anyway.
If he doesn't, he doesn't, Edmonds said. I just want you to try.
Okay.
He dropped his gaze to Edmonds' slowly swinging loafers and cast his mind outward toward his mommy and daddy. They were here someplace, right beyond that wall with the picture on it, as a matter of fact, in the waiting room where they had come in, sitting side by side but not talking, leafing through magazines, worried about him. He concentrated harder, his brow furrowing, trying to get into the feeling of his mommy's thoughts. It was always harder when they weren't right there in the room with him. Then he began to get it. Mommy was thinking about a sister, her sister. The sister was dead. His mommy was thinking that was the main thing that turned her mommy into such a bitch, into such an old biddy, because her sister had died. As a little girl, she was hit by a car. Oh, God, I could never stand anything like that again, like Eileen. But what if he's sick, really sick, cancer, spinal meningitis, leukemia, brain tumor, like John Gunther's son, or muscular dystrophy? Oh, geez, kids his age get leukemia all the time. Radium treatments, chemotherapy, we couldn't afford anything like that. But, of course, they just can't turn you out to die on the street, can they? And anyway, he's all right, all right, all right. You really shouldn't let yourself think, Danny, about Eileen and Danny, that car. Danny. But Tony wasn't there, only his voice. And, as it faded,
Danny followed it down into darkness, falling and tumbling down some magic hole between Dr. Bill's swinging loafers, past a loud knocking sound. Further, a bathtub cruised silently by in the darkness with some horrible thing lolling in it. Past a sound like sweetly chiming church bells. Past a clock under a dome of glass. Then the dark was pierced feebly by a single light, festooned with cobwebs. The weak glow disclosed a stone floor that looked damp and unpleasant. Somewhere not far distant was a steady mechanical roaring sound, but muted, not frightening, soporific. It was the thing that would be forgotten, Danny thought with dreamy surprise. As his eyes adjusted to the gloom, he could see Tony just ahead of him, a silhouette. Tony was looking at something, and Danny strained his eyes to see what it was.
Your daddy. See your daddy?
Of course he did. How could he have missed him, even in the basement light's feeble glow? Daddy was kneeling on the floor, casting the beam of a flashlight over old cardboard boxes and wooden crates. The cardboard boxes were mushy and old. Some of them had split open and spilled drifts of paper onto the floor. Newspapers, books, printed pieces of paper that looked like bills. His daddy was examining them with great interest. And then Daddy looked up and shone his flashlight in another direction. Its beam of light impaled another book, a large white one bound with gold string. The cover looked like white leather. It was a scrapbook. Danny suddenly needed to cry out to his daddy to tell him to leave that book alone, that some book should not be opened. But his daddy was climbing toward it. The mechanical roaring sound, which he now recognized as the boiler at the overlook which Daddy checked three or four times every day, had developed an ominous rhythmic hitching. It began to sound like pounding, and the smell of mildew and wet rotting paper was changing to something else, the high junipery smell of the bad stuff. It hung around his daddy like a vapor as he reached for the book and grasped it. Tony was somewhere in the darkness. This inhuman place makes human monsters. This inhuman place. Repeating the same incomprehensible thing over and over makes human monsters. Falling through darkness again, now accompanied by the heavy pounding thunder that was no longer the boiler, but the sound of a whistling mallet striking silk-papered walls, knocking out whiffs of plaster dust. Crouching helplessly on the blue-black woven jungle rug.
Come out, this inhuman place, and take your medicine.
Makes human monsters.
With a gasp that echoed in his own head as he jerked himself out of the darkness. Hands were on him, and at first he shrank back, thinking that the dark thing in the overlook of Tony's world had somehow followed him back into the world of real things. And then Dr. Edmonds was saying, "You're all right, Danny. You're all right. Everything is fine." Danny recognized the doctor, then his surroundings in the office. He began to shudder helplessly. Edmonds held him. When the reaction began to subside, Edmonds asked, "You said something about monsters, Danny. What was it?"
"This inhuman place," he said gutturally. "Tony told me this inhuman place makes...
He shook his head.
"Can't remember."
"Try."
"I can't."
"Did Tony come?"
"Yes."
"What did he show you?"
"Dark. Pounding. I don't remember."
"Where were you?"
"Leave me alone. I don't remember. Leave me alone."
He began to sob helplessly in fear and frustration. It was all gone, dissolved into a sticky mess like a wet bundle of paper, the memory unreadable. Edmonds went to the water cooler and got him a paper cup of water. Danny drank it, and Edmonds got him another one.
"Better?"
"Yes."
"Danny, I don't want to badger you, tease you about this, I mean, but can you remember anything about before Tony came?"
"My mommy," Danny said slowly. "She's worried about me."
"Mothers always are, Guy."
"No. She had a sister that died when she was a little girl, Eileen. She was thinking about how Eileen got hit by a car, and that made her worried about me. I don't remember anything else."
Edmonds was looking at him sharply.
"Just now she was thinking that, out in the waiting room?"
"Yes, sir."
"Danny, how would you know that?"
"I don't know," Danny said wanly. "The Shining, I guess."
"The what?"
Danny shook his head very slowly.
I'm awful tired. Can I go see my mommy and daddy? I don't want to answer any more questions. I'm tired. My stomach hurts.
Are you going to throw up?
No, sir. I just want to go see my mommy and daddy.
Okay, Dan. Edmund stood up. You go on out and see them for a minute, and then send them in so I can talk to them, okay?
Yes, sir.
There are books out there to look at. You like books, don't you?
Yes, sir,
Danny said dutifully. You're a good boy, Danny. Danny gave him a faint smile. I can't find a thing wrong with him, Dr. Edmund said to the Torrances. Well, not physically. Mentally, he's bright and rather too imaginative. It happens. Children have to grow into their imaginations like a pair of oversized shoes. Danny's is still way too big for him. Ever had his IQ tested? I don't believe in him, Jack said. They straitjacket the expectations of both parents and teachers. Dr. Edmonds nodded. That may be. But if you did test him, I think you'd find he's right off the scale for his age group. His verbal ability for a boy who's 5 going on 6 is amazing. We don't talk down to him, Jack said with a trace of pride. I doubt if you've ever had to in order to make yourself understood. Edmonds paused, fiddling with a pen. He went into a trance while I was with him, at my request, exactly as you described him in the bathroom last night. All his muscles went lax, his body slumped, his eyeballs rotated outward. Textbook auto-hypnosis. I was amazed. I still am. The Torrances sat forward. What happened? Wendy asked, tensely, and Edmonds carefully related Danny's trance, the muttered phrase from which Edmonds had only been able to pluck the word monsters, the dark, the pounding, the aftermath of tears, near hysteria, and nervous stomach. Tony again, Jack said.
What does it mean? Wendy asked. Have you any idea?
A few. You might not like them. Go ahead anyway, Jack told him. Well, from what Danny told me, his invisible friend was truly a friend until you folks moved out here from New England. Tony has only become a threatening figure since that move. The pleasant interludes have become nightmarish, even more frightening to your son because he can't remember exactly what the nightmares are about. Oh, that's common enough. We all remember our pleasant dreams more clearly than the scary ones. There seems to be a buffer somewhere between the conscious and the subconscious, and one hell of a blue nose lives in there. This sensor only lets through a small amount, and often what does come through is only symbolic. Well, that's oversimplified Freud, but it does pretty much describe what we know of the mind's interaction with itself.
You think moving has upset Danny that badly? Wendy asked.
It may have, if the move took place under traumatic circumstances, Edmund said.
Did it?
Wendy and Jack exchanged a glance. I was teaching at a prep school, Jack said slowly. I lost my job.
I see, Edmund said.
He put the pen he had been playing with firmly back in its holder.
There's more here, I'm afraid. It may be painful to you. Your son seems to believe you two have seriously contemplated divorce. He spoke of it in an offhand way, but only because he believes you are no longer considering it.
Jack's mouth dropped open, and Wendy recoiled as if slapped, the blood drained from her face.
We never even discussed it, she said. Well, not in front of him, not even in front of each other.
I think it's best if you understand everything, Doctor, Jack said.
Shortly after Danny was born, I became an alcoholic. I'd had a drinking problem all the way through college. It subsided a little after Wendy and I met, cropped up worse than ever after Danny was born, and the writing I considered to be my real work was going badly. When Danny was 3 and a half, he spilled some beer on a bunch of papers I was working on. Papers I was shuffling around, anyway. And I... Well... Oh, shit. His voice broke, but his eyes remained dry and unflinching. It sounds so goddamn beastly said out loud. I broke his arm, turning him around to spank him. 3 months later, I gave up drinking. I haven't touched it since.
I see, Edmund said neutrally. I knew the arm had been broken, of course. It was set well.
He pushed back from his desk a little and crossed his legs.
If I may be frank, it's obvious that he's been in no way abused since then. Other than the stings, there's nothing on him but the normal bruises and scabs that any kid has in abundance. Well, of course not, Wendy said hotly. Well, Jack didn't mean...
No, Wendy, Jack said. I meant to do it. I guess someplace inside I really did mean to do that to him. Or something even worse.
He looked back at Edmonds again.
You know something, Doctor? This is the first time the word divorce has been mentioned between us. And alcoholism and child beating. Three firsts in 5 minutes.
That may be at the root of the problem, Edmund said. I'm not a psychiatrist. If you want Danny to see a child psychiatrist, I can recommend a good one who works out of the Mission Ridge Medical Center in Boulder. But I am fairly confident of my diagnosis. Danny is an intelligent, imaginative, perceptive boy. I don't believe he would have been as upset by your marital problems as you believed. Small children are great acceptors. They don't understand shame or the need to hide things.
Jack was studying his hands. Wendy took one of them and squeezed it.
But he sensed that things were wrong. Chief among them, from his point of view, was not the broken arm, but the broken or breaking link between you two. He mentioned divorce to me, but not the broken arm. When my nurse mentioned the set to him, he simply shrugged it off. It was no pressure thing. It happened a long time ago, is what I think he said.
That kid, Jack muttered. His jaws were clamped together, the muscles in the cheeks standing out. We don't deserve him.
Now you have him all the same, Edmund said dryly. At any rate, he retires into a fantasy world from time to time. Nothing unusual about that, lots of kids do. As I recall, I had my own invisible friend when I was Danny's age, a talking rooster named Chug-Chug. Of course, no one could see Chug-Chug but me. I had two older brothers who often left me behind, and in such a situation, Chug-Chug came in mighty handy. And, of course, you two must understand why Danny's invisible friend is named Tony instead of Mike or Hal or Dutch.
Yes, Wendy said.
Have you ever pointed it out to him?
No, Jack said. Should we?
Why bother? Let him realize it in his own time by his own logic. You see, Danny's fantasies were considerably deeper than those that grow around the ordinary invisible friend syndrome. But he felt he needed Tony that much more. Tony would come and show him pleasant things, sometimes amazing things, always good things. Once, Tony showed him where Daddy's lost trunk was, under the stairs. Another time, Tony showed him that Mommy and Daddy were going to take him to an amusement park for his birthday. At Great Barrington, Wendy cried. But how could he know those things? It's eerie, the things he comes out with sometimes, almost as if
he had second sight, Edmonds asked, smiling.
He was born with a call, Wendy said weakly.
Edmund's smile became a good, hearty laugh. Jack and Wendy exchanged a glance and then also smiled, both of them amazed at how easy it was. Danny's occasional lucky guesses about things was something else they had not discussed much.
Next you'll be telling me he can levitate, Edmund said, still smiling.
No, 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 I'm afraid not. It's not extrasensory, but good old human perception, which, in Danny's case, is unusually keen.
Mr. Torrance, he knew your trunk was under the stairs because you had looked everywhere else. Process of elimination, what? It's so simple, Ellery Queen would laugh at it. Sooner or later, you would have thought of it yourself. As for the amusement park at Great Barrington, whose idea was that originally, yours or his?
Well, his, of course, Wendy said.
They advertised on all the morning children's programs. He was wild to go. But the thing is, Doctor, we couldn't afford to take him, and we had told him so.
Then a men's magazine I'd sold a story to back in 1971 sent a check for $50, Jack said. They were reprinting the story in an annual or something, so we decided to spend it on Danny.
Edmund shrugged. Wish fulfillment plus a lucky coincidence.
God damn it, I bet that's just right, Jack said.
Edmund smiled a little.
And Danny himself told me that Tony often showed him things that never occurred. Visions based on faulty perception, that's all. Danny is doing subconsciously what these so-called mystics and mind readers do quite consciously and cynically. I admire him for it. If life doesn't cause him to retract his antennae, I think he'll be quite a man.
Wendy nodded. Of course she thought Danny would be quite a man, but the doctor's explanation struck her as glib. It tasted more like margarine than butter. Edmonds had not lived with them. He had not been there when Danny found lost buttons,
told her that maybe the TV guide was under the bed, that he thought he'd better wear his rubbers to nursery school even though the sun was out, and later that day they had walked home under her umbrella through the pouring rain. Edmonds couldn't know of the curious way Danny had of pre-guessing them both. She would decide to have an unusual evening cup of tea, go out in the kitchen, and find her cup out with a tea bag in it. She would remember that the books were due at the library, and then find them all neatly piled up on the hall table, her library card on top. Or Jack would take it into his head to wax the Volkswagen, and find Danny already out there, listening to tinny Top 40 music on his crystal radio as he sat on the curb to watch. Aloud, she said, "Then why the nightmares now? Why did Tony tell him to lock the bathroom door?"
"I believe it's because Tony has outlived his usefulness," Edmund said. "He was born, Tony, not Danny, at a time when you and your husband were straining to keep your marriage together. Your husband was drinking too much, there was the incident of the broken arm, the ominous quiet between you."
Ominous quiet? Yes, that phrase was the real thing, anyway. The stiff, tense meals, where the only conversation had been, "Please pass the butter," or "Danny, eat the rest of your carrots," or "May I be excused, please?" The nights when Jack was gone and she had lain down, dry-eyed, on the couch while Danny watched TV. The mornings when she and Jack had stalked around each other like two angry cats with a quivering, frightened mouse between them. It all rang true. Dear God, do old scars ever stop hurting? Horribly, horribly true. Edmonds resumed.
"But things have changed. You know, schizoid behavior is a pretty common thing in children. It's accepted because all we adults have this unspoken agreement that children are lunatics. They have invisible friends. They may go and sit in the closet when they're depressed, withdrawing from the world. They attach talismanic importance to a special blanket or a teddy bear or a stuffed tiger. They suck their thumbs. When an adult sees things that aren't there, we consider him ready for the rubber room. When a child says he's seen a troll in his bedroom or a vampire outside the window, we simply smile indulgently. We have a one-sentence explanation that explains the whole range of such phenomena in children."
"He'll grow out of it," Jack said. Edmonds blinked.
"In my very words," he said. "Yes. Now, I would guess that Danny was in a pretty good position to develop a full-fledged psychosis. Unhappy home life, a big imagination, the invisible friend who was so real to him that he nearly became real to you. Instead of growing out of his childhood schizophrenia, he might well have grown into it."
"And become autistic?" Wendy asked. She had read about autism. The word itself frightened her. It sounded like dread and white silence.
"Possibly, but not necessarily. He might simply have entered Tony's world someday and never come back to what he calls real things."
"God," Jack said.
"But now, the basic situation has changed drastically. Mr. Torrance no longer drinks. You're in a new place, where conditions have forced the three of you into a tighter family unit than ever before. Certainly tighter than my own, where my wife and kids may see me for only 2 or 3 hours a day. To my mind, he is in the perfect healing situation. And I think the very fact that he is able to differentiate so sharply between Tony's world and real things says a lot about the fundamentally healthy state of his mind. He says that you two are no longer considering divorce. Is he as right as I think he is?"
"Yes," Wendy said, and Jack squeezed her hand tightly, almost painfully. She squeezed back. Edmonds nodded.
"He really doesn't need Tony anymore. Danny is flushing him out of his system. Tony no longer brings pleasant visions, but hostile nightmares that are too frightening for him to remember except fragmentarily. He internalized Tony during a difficult, desperate life situation, and Tony is not leaving easily, but he is leaving. Your son is a little like a junkie kicking the habit."
He stood up, and the Torrances stood also.
"As I said, I'm not a psychiatrist. If the nightmares are still continuing when your job at the Overlook ends next spring, Mr. Torrance, I would strongly urge you to take him to this man in Boulder."
"I will."
"Well, let's go out and tell him he can go home," Edmund said.
"I want to thank you," Jack told him painfully. "I feel better about all this than I have in a very long time."
"So do I," Wendy said.
At the door, Edmonds paused and looked at Wendy.
"Do you, or did you, have a sister, Mrs. Torrance, named Eileen?"
Wendy looked at him surprised.
"Yes, I did,"
She was killed outside our home in Somersworth, New Hampshire, when she was 6 and I was 10. She chased a ball into the street and was struck by a delivery van.
Does Danny know that?
I don't know. I don't think so.
He says you were thinking about her in the waiting room.
I was, Wendy said slowly. For the first time in, I don't know how long.
Does the word Redrum mean anything to either of you?
Wendy shook her head, but Jack said, he mentioned that word last night, just before he went to sleep. Red drum.
No, rum, Edmonds corrected. He was quite emphatic about that. Rum, as in the drink, the alcoholic drink.
Oh, Jack said. It fits in, doesn't it? He took his handkerchief out of his back pocket and wiped his lips with it.
Does the phrase, the shining, mean anything to you?
This time they both shook their heads.
Doesn't matter, I guess, Edmonds said.
He opened the door into the waiting room.
Anybody here named Danny Torrance that would like to go home? Hi, Daddy. Hi, Mommy.
He stood up from the small table where he had been leafing slowly through a copy of Where the Wild Things Are and muttering the words he knew aloud. He ran to Jack, who scooped him up. Wendy ruffled his hair. Edmonds peered at him.
If you don't love your mommy and daddy, you can stay with good old Bill.
No, sir, Danny said emphatically. He slung one arm around Jack's neck, one arm around Wendy's, and looked radiantly happy.
Okay, Edmonds said, smiling. He looked at Wendy. You call if you have any problems.
Yes.
I don't think you will, Edmonds said, smiling.
Chapter 18. The Scrapbook. Jack found the scrapbook on the 1st of November, while his wife and son were hiking up the rutted old road that ran from behind the rope court to a deserted sawmill 2 miles further up. The fine weather still held, and all three of them had acquired improbable autumn suntans. He had gone down in the basement to knock the press down on the boiler, and then, on impulse, he had taken the flashlight from the shelf where the plumbing schematics were and decided to look at some of the old papers. He was also looking for good places to set his traps, although he didn't plan to do that for another month. I want them all to be home from vacation, he had told Wendy. Shining the flashlight ahead of him, he stepped past the elevator shaft, at Wendy's insistence they hadn't used the elevator since they moved in, and through the small stone arch. His nose wrinkled at the smell of rotting paper. Behind him, the boiler kicked on with a thundering whoosh, making him jump. He flickered the light around, whistling tunelessly between his teeth. There was a scale model Andes range down here. Dozens of boxes and crates stuffed with papers, most of them white and shapeless with age and damp. Others had broken open and spilled yellow sheaves of paper onto the stone floor. There were bales of newspaper tied up with hay rope. Some boxes contained what looked like ledgers, and others contained invoices bound with rubber bands. Jack pulled one out and put the flashlight beam on it. Rocky Mountain Express Incorporated, 2 Overlook Hotel, from Sydney's Warehouse, 1210 16th Street, Denver, Colorado, via Canadian Pacific Railroad. Contents, 400 cases Delsey toilet tissue, 1 gross slash case. Signed, DEF, date August 24, 1954. Smiling, Jack let the paper drop back into the box. He flashed the light above it, and it speared a hanging light bulb, almost buried in cobwebs. There was no chain pull. He stood on tiptoe and tried screwing the bulb in. It lit weakly. He picked up the toilet paper invoice again and used it to wipe off some of the cobwebs. The glow didn't brighten much. Still using the flashlight, he wandered through the boxes and bales of paper looking for rat spoor. They had been here, but not for quite a long time, maybe years. He found some droppings that were powdery with age, and several nests of neatly shredded paper that were old and unused. Jack pulled a newspaper from one of the bundles and glanced down at the headline. Johnson promises orderly transition. Says work begun by JFK will go forward in coming year. The paper was the Rocky Mountain News, dated December 19, 1963. He dropped it back onto its pile. He supposed he was fascinated by that commonplace sense of history that anyone can feel glancing through the fresh news of 10 or 20 years ago. He found gaps in the piled newspapers and records. Nothing from 1937 to 1945, from 1957 to 1960, from 1962 to 1963. Periods when the hotel had been closed, he guessed, when it had been between suckers grabbing for the brass ring. Ullman's explanations of the Overlook's checkered career still didn't ring quite true to him. It seemed that the Overlook's spectacular location alone should have guaranteed its continuing success. There had always been an American jet set, even before jets were invented, and it seemed to Jack that the Overlook should have been one of the bases they touched in their migrations. It even sounded right. The Waldorf in May, the Bar Harbor House in June and July, the Overlook in August and early September, before moving on to Bermuda, Havana, Rio, wherever. He found a pile of old desk registers, and they bore him out. Nelson Rockefeller in 1950, Henry Ford and Family in 1927, Gene Harlow in 1930, Clark Abel and Carol Lombard. In 1956, the whole top floor had been taken for a week by Darrell F. Zanuck and party. The money must have rolled down the corridors and into the cash registers like a 20th century Comstock load. The management must have been spectacularly bad. There was history here, all right, and not just in newspaper headlines. It was buried between the entries in these ledgers and account books and room service chits where you couldn't quite see it. In 1922, Warren G. Harding had ordered a whole salmon at 10 o'clock in the evening and a case of Coors beer. But whom had he been eating and drinking with? Had it been a poker game, a strategy session, what? Jack glanced at his watch and was surprised to see the 45 minutes had somehow slipped by since he had come down here. His hands and arms were grimy, and he probably smelled bad. He decided to go up and take a shower before Wendy and Danny got back. He walked slowly between the mountains of paper, his mind alive and ticking over possibilities in a speedy way that was exhilarating. He hadn't felt this way in years. It suddenly seemed that the book he had semi-jokingly promised himself might really happen. It might even be right here, buried in these untidy heaps of paper. It could be a work of fiction, or history, or both. A long book exploding out of this central place in 100 directions. He stood beneath the cobwebby light, took his handkerchief from his back pocket without thinking, and scrubbed at his lips with it. And that was when he saw the scrapbook. A pile of 5 boxes stood on his left like some tottering Pisa. The one on top was stuffed with more invoices and ledgers. Balanced on top of those, keeping its angle of repose for who know how many years, was a thick scrapbook with white leather covers, its pages bound with 2 hanks of gold string that had been tied along the binding in gaudy bows. Curious, he went over and took it down. The top cover was thick with dust. He held it on a plane at lip level, blew the dust off in a cloud, and opened it. As he did so, a card fluttered out, and he grabbed it in midair before it could fall to the stone floor. It was rich and creamy, dominated by a raised engraving of the Overlook with every window alight. The lawn and playground were decorated with glowing Japanese lanterns. It looked almost as though you could step right into it, an Overlook hotel that had existed 30 years ago. Horace M. Derwent requests the pleasure of your company at a masked ball to celebrate the grand opening of the Overlook Hotel. Dinner will be served at 8 p.m., unmasking and dancing at midnight. August 29, 1945, RSVP. Dinner at 8, unmasking at midnight. He could almost see them in the dining room, the richest men in America and their women. Tuxedos in glimmering starched shirts, evening gowns, the band playing, gleaming high-heeled pumps, the clink of glasses, the jocund pop of champagne corks. The war was over, or almost over. The future lay ahead, clean and shining. America was the colossus of the world, and at last she knew it and accepted it. And later, at midnight, Derwent himself crying, "Unmask! Unmask!" The masks coming off, and the Red Death held sway over all. He frowned. What left field did that come out of? That was Poe, the great American hack. And surely the Overlook, this shining, glowing Overlook on the invitation he held in his hands, was the farthest cry from E.A. Poe imaginable. He put the invitation back and turned to the next page, a paste-up from one of the Denver papers, and scratched beneath it the date, May 15, 1947. Posh Mountain Resort reopens with stellar guest register. Derwent says Overlook will be showplace of the world. By David Felton, features editor. The Overlook Hotel has been opened and reopened in its 38-year history, but rarely with such style and dash as that promised by Horace Derwent, the mysterious California millionaire who is the latest owner of the hostelry. Derwent, who makes no secret of having sunk more than $1 million into his newest venture, and some say the figure is closer to 3 million, says that the new Overlook will be one of the world show places, the kind of hotel you will remember overnighting in 30 years later. When Derwent, who is rumored to have substantial Las Vegas holdings, was asked if his purchase and refurbishing of the Overlook signaled the opening gun in a battle to legalize casino-style gambling in Colorado, the aircraft, movie, munitions, and shipping magnate denied it with a smile. The Overlook would be cheapened by gambling, he said. And don't think I'm knocking Vegas. They've got too many of my markers out there for me to do that. I have no interest in lobbying for legalized gambling in Colorado. It would be spitting into the wind. When the Overlook opens officially, there was a gigantic and hugely successful party there some time ago when the actual work was finished. The newly painted, papered, and decorated rooms will be occupied by a stellar guest list ranging from chic designer Corbett Stanny to... Smiling bemusedly, Jack turned the page. Now, he was looking at a full-page ad from the New York Sunday Times travel section. On the page after that, a story on Derwent himself, a balding man with eyes that pierced you even from an old newsprint photo. He was wearing rimless spectacles and a 40s-style pencil-lined mustache that did nothing at all to make him look like Errol Flynn. His face was that of an accountant. It was the eyes that made him look like someone or something else. Jack skimmed the article rapidly. He knew most of the information from a Newsweek story on Derwent the year before. Born poor in St. Paul, never finished high school, joined the Navy instead, rose rapidly, then left in a bitter wrangle over the patent on a new type of propeller that he had designed. In the tug-of-war between the Navy and an unknown young man named Horace Derwent, Uncle Sam came off the predictable winner. But Uncle Sam had never gotten another patent, and there had been a lot of them. In the late 20s and early 30s, Derwent turned to aviation. He bought out a bankrupt crop-dusting company, turned it into an airmail service, and prospered. More patents followed. A new monoplane wing design, a bomb carriage used on the flying fortresses that had rained fire on Hamburg and Dresden and Berlin, a machine gun that was cooled by alcohol, a prototype of the ejection seat later used in the United States jets. And along the line, the accountant, who lived in the same skin as the inventor, kept piling up the investments. A piddling string of munitions factories in New York and New Jersey, 5 textile mills in New England, chemical factories in the bankrupt and groaning South. At the end of the Depression, his wealth had been nothing but a handful of controlling interests, bought at abysmally low prices, saleable only at lower prices still. At one point, Derwent boasted that he could liquidate completely and realize the price of a 3-year-old Chevrolet. There had been rumors, Jack recalled, that some of the means employed by Derwent to keep his head above water were less than savory. Involvement with bootlegging, prostitution in the Midwest, smuggling in the coastal areas of the South where his fertilizer factories were. Finally, an association with the nascent Western gambling interests. Probably Derwent's most famous investment was the purchase of the foundering Top Mark Studios, which had not had a hit since their child star, Little Marjorie Morris, had died of a heroin overdose in 1934. She was 14. Little Marjorie, who had specialized in sweet 7-year-olds who saved marriages and the lives of dogs unjustly accused of killing chickens, had been given the biggest Hollywood funeral in history by Top Mark. The official story was that Little Marjorie had contracted a wasting disease while entertaining at a New York orphanage. And some cynics suggested the studio had laid out all that long green because it knew it was burying itself. Derwent hired a keen businessman and raging sex maniac named Henry Finkel to run Top Mark. And in the 2 years before Pearl Harbor, the studio ground out 60 movies, 55 of which glided right into the face of the Hays office and spit on its large blue nose. The other 5 were government training films. The feature films were huge successes. During one of them, an unnamed costume designer had jury-rigged a strapless bra for the heroine to appear in during the grand ball scene, where she revealed everything except possibly the birthmark just below the cleft of her buttocks. Derwent received credit for this invention as well, and his reputation, or notoriety, grew. The war had made him rich, and he was still rich. Living in Chicago, seldom seen except for Derwent Enterprises board meetings, which he ran with an iron hand, it was rumored that he owned United Airlines, Las Vegas, where he was known to have controlling interests in 4 hotel casinos and some involvement in at least 6 others, Los Angeles, and the USA itself. Reputed to be a friend of royalty, presidents, and underworld kingpins, It was supposed by many that he was the richest man in the world. But he had not been able to make a go of the Overlook, Jack thought. He put the scrapbook down for a moment and took the small notebook and mechanical pencil he always kept with him out of his breast pocket. He jotted, "Look into H. Derwent, Sidewinder Library." He put the notebook back and picked up the scrapbook again. His face was preoccupied, his eyes distant. He wiped his mouth constantly with his hand as he turned the pages. He skimmed the material that followed, making a mental note to read it more closely later. Press releases were pasted into many of the pages. So-and-so was expected at the Overlook next week, thus-and-such would be entertaining in the lounge. In Derwent's time, it had been the Red Eye Lounge. Many of the entertainers were Vegas names, and many of the guests were top mark executives and stars. Then, in a clipping marked February 1, 1952, "Millionaire Exec to Sell Colorado Investments. Deal made with California investors on Overlook, other investments," Derwent reveals. By Rodney Conklin, financial editor. In a terse communique yesterday from the Chicago offices of the monolithic Derwent Enterprises, it was revealed that millionaire, perhaps billionaire, Horace Derwent has sold out of Colorado in a stunning financial power play that will be completed by October 1, 1954. Derwent's investments include natural gas, coal, hydroelectric power, and a land development company called Colorado Sunshine Incorporated, which owns or holds options on better than 500,000 acres of Colorado land. The most famous Derwent holding in Colorado, the Overlook Hotel, has already been sold, Derwent revealed in a rare interview yesterday. The buyer was a California group of investors headed by Charles Grondin, a former director of the California Land Development Corporation. While Derwent refused to discuss price, informed sources, he had sold out everything, lock, stock, and barrel. It wasn't just the Overlook, but somehow, he wiped his lips with his hand and wished he had a drink. This would go better with a drink. He turned more pages. The California group had opened the hotel for two seasons and then sold it to a Colorado group called Mountain View Resorts. Mountain View went bankrupt in 1957 amid charges of corruption, nest feathering, and cheating the stockholders. The president of the company shot himself 2 days after being subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury. The hotel had been closed for the rest of the decade. There was a single story about it, a Sunday feature headlined, "Former Grand Hotel Sinking into Decay." The accompanying photos wrenched at Jack's heart, the paint on the front porch peeling, the lawn a bald and scabrous mess, windows broken by storms and stones. This would be a part of the book, if he actually wrote it, too. The Phoenix, going down into the ashes to be reborn. He promised himself he would take care of the place, very good care. It seemed that before today, he had never really understood the breadth of his responsibility to the Overlook. It was almost like having a responsibility to history. In 1961, four writers, two of them Pulitzer Prize winners, had leased the Overlook and reopened it as a writer's school. That had lasted 1 year. One of the students had gotten drunk in his third-floor room, crashed out of the window somehow, and fell to his death on the cement terrace below. The paper hinted that it might have been suicide. "Any big hotel's that got scandals," Watson had said, "just like every big hotel has got a ghost. Why? Hell, people come and go." Suddenly it seemed that he could almost feel the weight of the Overlook bearing down on him from above, 110 guest rooms, the storage rooms, kitchen, pantry, freezer, lounge, ballroom, dining room. In the room the women come and go, and the Red Death held sway over all. He rubbed his lips and turned to the next page in the scrapbook. He was in the last third of it now, and for the first time he wondered consciously whose book this was, left atop the highest pile of records in the cellar. A new headline, this one dated April 10, 1963. Las Vegas Group buys famed Colorado hotel, scenic overlook to become Key Club. Robert T. Leffing, spokesman for a group of investors going under the name of High Country Investments, announced today in Las Vegas that High Country has negotiated a deal for the famous Overlook Hotel, a resort located high in the Rockies. Leffing declined to mention the names of specific investors, but he said the hotel would be turned into an exclusive Key Club. He said that the group he represents hopes to sell memberships to high echelon executives in American and foreign companies. High Country also owns hotels in Montana, Wyoming, and Utah. The Overlook became world-known in the years 1946 to 1952, when it was owned by elusive mega-millionaire Horace Derwent, who... The item on the next page was a mere squib, dated 4 months later. The Overlook had opened under its new management. Apparently, the paper hadn't been able to find out or wasn't interested in who the key holders were, because no names were mentioned, but High Country Investments, the most anonymous-sounding company name Jack had ever heard, except for a chain of bike and appliance shops in western New England that went under the name of Business Incorporated. He turned the page and blinked down at the clipping pasted there. Millionaire Derwent back in Colorado via back door. High Country exec revealed to be Charles Grondin. By Rodney Conklin, financial editor. The Overlook Hotel, a scenic pleasure palace in the Colorado High Country and once the private plaything of millionaire Horace Derwent, is at the center of a financial tangle which is only now beginning to come to light. On April 10 of last year, the hotel was purchased by a Las Vegas firm, High Country Investments, as a key club for wealthy executives of both foreign and domestic breeds. Now, informed sources say that High Country is headed by Charles Grondin, 53, who was the head of California Land Development Corporation until 1959, when he resigned to take the position of executive VP in the Chicago home office of Derwent Enterprises. This has led to speculation that High Country Investments may be controlled by Derwent, who may have acquired the Overlook for the second time and under decidedly peculiar circumstances. Grondin, who was indicted and acquitted on charges of tax evasion in 1960, could not be reached for comment, and Horace Derwent, who guards his own privacy jealously, had no comment when reached by telephone. State Representative Dick Bowes of Golden has called for a complete investigation into... Well, that clipping was dated July 27, 1964. The next was a column from a Sunday paper that September. The byline belonged to Josh Braniger, a muckraking investigator of the Jack Anderson breed. Jack vaguely recalled that Braniger had died in 1968 or 69. Mafia-free zone in Colorado by Josh Braniger. It now seems possible that the newest R&R spot of organization overlords in the U.S. is located at an out-of-the-way hotel nestled in the center of the Rockies. The Overlook Hotel, a white elephant that has been run lucklessly by almost a dozen different groups and individuals since it first opened its doors in 1910, is now being operated as a security-jacketed key club, ostensibly for unwinding businessmen. The question is, what business are the Overlook's key holders really in? The members present during the week of August 16 through 23 may give us an idea. The list below was obtained by a former employee of High Country Investments, a company first believed to be a dummy company owned by Derwent Enterprises. It now seems more likely that Derwent's interest in High Country, if any, is outweighed by those of several Las Vegas gambling barons. And these same gaming honchos have been linked in the past to both suspected and convicted underworld kingpins. Present at the Overlook during that sunny week in August were Charles Grondin, president of High Country Investments. When it became known in July of this year that he was running the High Country ship, it was announced, considerably after the fact, that he had resigned his position in Derwent Enterprises previously. The silver-maned Grondin, who refused to talk to me for this column, has been tried once and acquitted on tax evasion charges, 1960. Charles Baby Charlie Battaglia, a 60-year-old Vegas impresario, controlling interests in the Greenback and the Lucky Bones on the Strip. Battaglia is a close personal friend of Grondin. His arrest record stretches back to 1932, when he was tried and acquitted in the gangland-style murder of Jack Dutchie Morgan. Federal authorities suspect his involvement in the drug traffic, prostitution, and murder for hire. But Baby Charlie has only been behind bars once, for income tax evasion, in 1955-56. Richard Scarn, the principal stockholder of Funtime Automatic Machines. Funtime makes slot machines for the Nevada crowd, pinball machines and jukeboxes, Melody Coin, for the rest of the country. He has done time for assault with a deadly weapon, 1940, carrying a concealed weapon, 1948, and conspiracy to commit tax fraud, 1961. Peter Zeiss, a Miami-based importer, now nearing 70. For the last 5 years, Zeiss has been fighting deportation as an undesirable person. He has been convicted on charges of receiving and concealing stolen property, 1958, and conspiracy to commit tax fraud, 1954. Charming, distinguished, and courtly, P. Pete Zeiss is called Papa by his intimates and has been tried on charges of murder and accessory to murder. A large stockholder in Scarn's Funtime Company, he also has known interests in four Las Vegas casinos. Vittorio Gianelli, also known as Vito the Chopper, tried twice for gangland-style murders, one of them the axe murder of Boston Vice Overlord Frank Scoffi. Gianelli has been indicted 23 times, tried 14 times, and convicted only once for shoplifting in 1940. It has been said that in recent years, Gianelli has become a power in the organization's Western operation, which is centered in Las Vegas. Carl Jimmy Ricks Prashkin, a San Francisco investor, reported to be the heir apparent of the power Gianelli now wields. Prashkin owns large blocks of stock in Derwent Enterprises, High Country Investments, Funtime Automatic Machines, and three Vegas casinos. Prashkin is clean in America, but was indicted in Mexico on fraud charges that were dropped quickly 3 weeks after they were brought. It has been suggested that Prashkin may be in charge of laundering money skimmed from Vegas casino operations and funneling the big bucks back into the organization's legitimate Western operations. And such operations may now include the Overlook Hotel in Colorado. Other visitors during the current season include... There was more, but Jack only skimmed it, constantly wiping his lips with his hand. A banker with Las Vegas connections. Men from New York who are apparently doing more in the garment district than making clothes. Men reputed to be involved with drugs, vice, robbery, murder. God, what a story! And they had all been here, right above him, in these empty rooms. Screwing expensive whores on the third floor, maybe. Drinking magnums of champagne, making deals that would turn over millions of dollars, maybe in the very suite of rooms where presidents had stayed. Well, there was a story, all right. One hell of a story. A little frantically, he took out his notebook and jotted down another memo to check all of these people out at the library in Denver when the caretaking job was over. Every hotel has its ghost. The Overlook had a whole coven of them. First suicide, then the mafia. What next? The next clipping was an angry denial of Branniger's charges by Charles Grondin. Jack smirked at it. The clipping on the next page was so large that it had been folded. Jack unfolded it and gasped harshly. The picture there seemed to leap out at him. The wallpaper had been changed since June of 1966, but he knew that window and that view perfectly well. It was the western exposure of the presidential suite. Murder came next. The sitting room wall by the door leading into the bedroom was splashed with blood and what could only be white flecks of brain matter. A blank-faced cop was standing over a corpse hidden by a blanket. Jack stared, fascinated, and then his eyes moved up to the headline. Gangland-style shooting at Colorado Hotel. Reputed crime overlord shot at Mountain Key Club. Two others dead. Sidewinder, Colorado, UPI. 40 miles from this sleepy Colorado town, a gangland-style execution has occurred in the heart of the Rocky Mountains. The Overlook Hotel, purchased 3 years ago as an exclusive key club by a Las Vegas firm, was the site of a triple shotgun slaying. Two of the men were either the companions or bodyguards of Vittorio Gianelli, also known as the Chopper, for his reputed involvement in a Boston slaying 20 years ago. Police were summoned by Robert Norman, manager of the Overlook, who said he heard shots and that some of the guests reported two men wearing stockings on their faces and carrying guns had fled down the fire escape and driven off in a late-model tan convertible. State Trooper Benjamin Moorer discovered two dead men, later identified as Victor T. Borman and Roger McCassey, both of Las Vegas, outside the door of the presidential suite where two American presidents have stayed. Inside, Moorer found the body of Gianelli sprawled on the floor. Gianelli was apparently fleeing his attackers when he was cut down. Moorer said Gianelli had been shot with heavy-gauge shotguns at close range. Charles Grondin, the representative of the company which now owns the Overlook, could not be reached for... Below the clipping, in heavy strokes of a ballpoint pen, someone had written, "They took his balls along with them." Jack stared at that for a long time, feeling cold. Whose book was this? He turned the page at last, swallowing a click in his throat. Another column from Josh Branniger, this one dated early 1967. He only read the headline, "Notorious Hotel Sold Following Murder of Underworld Figure." The sheets following that clipping were blank. They took his balls along with them. He flipped back to the beginning, looking for a name or address. even a room number, because he felt quite sure that whoever had kept this little book of memories had stayed at the hotel. But there was nothing.